I truly am grateful for having been invited to be with you in this good lectureship. To the elders and to those who work on the lectureship, I'm very, very grateful for the invitation to speak. We've had excellent lectures so far today. I think we've had two who felt like pork chops in a Jewish synagogue, and one who felt like a small fish in a large pond, and I identify with all of them. I feel like a small fish in a Jewish synagogue. But I'm very, very pleased to be here and to try to help continue the excellent job that others have begun doing on this important book of Matthew. Andy, just a little while ago, brought us up to the end of chapter 13, and I will begin in chapter 14. We have seen so far that Jesus has begun his ministry, has begun to amaze people with the amazing knowledge that he has and the wisdom that he has. People are beginning to wonder who he is as the true story of his history develops in this book. Then we come to chapter 14 and begin seeing how certain people are reacting to the work that Jesus was doing. The first one is Herod. Human nature really has not changed that much in all of the years that man has been upon this earth. I don't know if you can easily divide people into the categories that I'm going to maybe too simplistically divide them into, but there are some people who want power in this world. They want everyone to admire them and to bow at their feet, and they want to be seen as somewhat, and they try very hard to become important people, big shots. Well, there are some other people who aspire to be like that but aren't there yet, and so spend a lot of time trying to get the attention of those who are seen as somewhat, and their motives often are to impress those who they see as being higher on the ladder than they are. Then another category of people may be those who just blindly and uncritically follow what those who seem to be somewhat say. All of these are categories that are different from the category we ought to be trying to be a part of, and that is that category of people that will try to learn what is right and what is good and what is true and do that. Whether or not people admire it, whether or not people admire us because we do it, whether or not the masses of people agree with us, we need to try to be a part of that group that will not change in order to be pleasing to the world around us. As we look at the chapters before us, we're going to see some characters. And as we look at them, let's look for some of these attitudes and actions. Some of them we ought to try very hard to not be like. And some of them we ought to try very hard to be like, because some attitudes and actions are right and some attitudes and actions are wrong. Well, let's look first of all in chapter 14 at the death of John the Baptist and the events that relate to that. We begin here with Herod. He is the one who is the political leader of this region, and we won't go into a great deal about that. You can read the material in the book and find excellent material elsewhere. But here is Herod, a politician. A person who in the eyes of the world, and no doubt when he looked in the mirror, who was seen to be a big shot. Someone who you did not want to challenge. Herod had an adulterous relationship, and you might say also, in a sense, an incestuous relationship with his brother's wife. Herod was one who apparently, as we look at this, was used to getting his way. A lot of people like to mollycoddle politicians and people who they see as being in positions of power, and you can't help but get a sense that he was accustomed to getting his way. Now, he was easily manipulated by his wife, as we see as we go through here. Some of the things that he did, he put John the Baptist in prison for his wife's sake, and we're going to see that the death of John the Baptist was because of his wife's desire transferred through the daughter. But he was one who would do whatever it would take to cause people to encourage him, when he could, to admire him, when he could do that. Well, another character in this same story is John the Baptist. Not given to soft living like Herod, John the Baptist was one who had truth and conviction of the truth and duty. John had the truth of God and knew what was right and what was true and what ought to be done, not because John the Baptist was wise by his own wisdom. He was wise because he had studied the revelation of God and knew what was true. Well, John the Baptist, with courage, conviction, not given to hard, not given to soft living, but given to hard living, encountered Herod. Herod had his father's, or his brother's wife. John the Baptist had the truth, and he had conviction about the truth, and there had to be a collision. You cannot just walk away and ignore such obvious deviation from the will of God among those who claim to be those who are doing what is right. John had the truth on the subject of marriage and divorce and remarriage. For his own time and under his own covenant, he knew what was right, and he revealed it to Herod. Now, sometimes people get this out of order, but John didn't. John knew that God exists. God reveals to us truth. When we study truth, we must draw proper conclusions. And after we've drawn those conclusions have consequences. Now, John had no problem understanding that God exists and he has revealed certain truth, and that truth has conclusions that are implied by all of the truths on the subject, and there are consequences for those truths. And so John didn't have any difficulty in applying what God's word generally taught to this specific situation that was violating the will of God. But we need to keep the same order in our own minds. Sometimes you talk with brethren about difficult questions, difficult in the sense that they are difficult to obey, not because they're difficult to understand many times. And many times people will argue beginning with the consequences. Not long ago, someone in a Bible class where I preach wanted to argue that while we were talking about Matthew 19:9, that this simply does not apply to non-Christians, they said, and argued and argued and brought it out, took it out into the parking lot and argued some more on the subject. And later we discussed it in a more open way or among some other brethren. And rather than arguing from Matthew 19:9, not even discussing the truth taught there, not even discussing the conclusions that one would draw from that, his argument was straight to the consequences. And he said, "I just don't think you ever have any right to tell two people they ought to separate." Notice how far removed from the source you are when you begin arguing with the consequence. If the truth is there, if God does exist, and he does, and if God's truth is true, and it is, if those truths can be understood, the application is the easiest part in the mind to understand what ought to be done. But sometimes we think that we can start here and then swim backwards to see if we can't find some way to justify the conclusion that we like. Anyway, John the Baptist did not do that. He had the truth, he knew what was right, and he did not spend his time like we often do saying, "Now what if? Now I know I have the truth, but this is a big shot in this circumstance." Not only is he a big shot in that he can influence public opinion, but he could kill me if I taught the truth to this man. You know, I've seen brethren back away from confronting serious sinners for a whole lot less reason than that. Just because someone somewhere might not like it, they back away. And yet John the Baptist, with the truth and with the knowledge that he had of the situation of Herod, had no right. You have a duty at such times to simply reveal the consequences that God's word would say apply to those situations. John had the truth And with that truth, he had duty. Well, Herod, you might say, was a man of principle. Like many politicians, he had principles that guided his behavior. And if I understand correctly, the main principle that he had was, whatever will benefit me and keep me afloat politically, that's what I will do. So he was principled, but the principle was way off and wrong. Here was John the Baptist in prison already because of Herod's wife, appreciating some of the things that he had to say about her marriage to Herod. The daughter of Herodias, or the daughter of Herod, Herod's wife, danced for him upon his birthday, and he made a promise. Whatsoever you want, I'll give it to you. Now, that's pretty much a blank check. It did have some limitations, but at the same time, he did not limit himself to very much that he would not do that she would ask. And in fact, we see how Herod responds after he made this oath or this promise. And it would be an interesting thing to ask Herod to interpret Matthew 19:9 for us. He understood that whatsoever meant whatever you ask. He would also understand that whosoever would mean whoever there is. And he wouldn't have had any difficulty in our day interpreting what many of our brethren have a great deal of difficulty understanding, but it was fairly simple. She did this dance for him, and he made this promise in a public way. We're going to see that he carried out his promise. When she asked to have the head of John the Baptist, he carried it out. But why? You might first of all say, even when reading this, and say, well, he made an oath, and that's why. But two reasons are given, and they have to be together to make sense. There were two reasons: the oath and them which sat at meat with them, or sat with him at meat. If he had only had the oath and no one witnessing it, he would not have done it. He was a man of principle, and the principle would have allowed him to skip what he had promised, as long as it wouldn't hurt him politically. But his principle had now placed him in a dilemma. He had made a public promise. There were not even any tape recorders in the room. And he could have said, if he had watched how many people today operate, he could have said, now you just took my promise out of context and did not understand what I really meant. Then he would have come up with some other thing that he really meant that was close to that, I suppose, or modified in some way. But he wasn't smart enough to do that, I suppose. And so he just had to acknowledge that he had made a public promise, and now he was going to do it. Well, he didn't personally want to harm John the Baptist. John the Baptist was already in prison because his wife wanted him in there. He personally admired John the Baptist and even liked to hear him preach as long as the subject was not his marriage to his brother's wife. He enjoyed hearing John the Baptist preach. Well, with all of those things aside, he now had a promise, and the people believed that John was a prophet. And so he could not keep the favor of the people if he were to put John the Baptist to death, but he could not keep the favor of those who had heard him make a promise if he did not do it. And so he had a dilemma and settled it by taking his chances with taking the life of John the Baptist. Well, he admired John the Baptist. He knew that John the Baptist was a powerful man, and that people admired John the Baptist, and now he had put him to death. I suppose we all make some decisions in our lives that cause us to have second thoughts, but Herod apparently was filled with fear. He was aware of the fact that he had done a wrong thing, that he had guilt in this matter. And he, under those circumstances, was apparently really on the lookout for some consequence to follow this thing that he had done. Now, at least we can't help but suspect that that is true. We come to this chapter, Matthew 14. Herod is hearing about Jesus. Jesus is now gaining a great deal of notoriety. He has performed some miracles, he's preaching and becoming well known. And the first thing that Herod thinks when he finds out or hears of this one called Jesus, doing these mighty things and having this great wisdom is that this is John the Baptist, risen from the dead. Now, he must have had some inner work, inner guilt, inner feelings about what was going to happen as a consequence of killing this great man. We don't run into two great men like that in our lifetimes. Most of us do not. And here he had the wrong conclusion that Jesus was John the Baptist. There were some other people who argued that he was someone else, like one of the prophets or one of the prophets. But Herod just could not shake the idea that this is John the Baptist raised from the dead. Well, he later was able to interview Christ during his trial period later on, but it appears that he could not shake the idea, because of his guilt associated with killing John the Baptist, that Jesus was that man. Well, beginning in verse 13 of chapter 14, we read of Jesus feeding the 5,000. Immediately after learning about the death of John the Baptist, Jesus withdrew to a remote place. And while he was there, he taught the people and he healed the people. And while he was doing that, the disciples came to him saying, "We ought to send the people away. They need to get some food." A very simple series of things happened in one sense. He told them that we'll feed them, in effect. And with 5 loaves and 2 fishes, he fed the 5,000 plus the women and the children. So try to think of this as the popularity of Jesus being disclosed to the people, or they're becoming more and more aware of this miracle worker. That's a lot of people to be fed in a small geographical area by a miracle. And so they knew that Jesus was a person sent from God. Then, while he is dismissing the people, he tells the disciples to cross over the sea, and he would catch up with them. Well, that all sounds like it's not very much of a command, but we're going to see in just a little while that the disciples began taking their boat across the sea, and after they had gone out about 3 to 3.5 miles, a storm was brewing, and they couldn't proceed. Now, just try to think about what that is like. I haven't been that exhausted, as I assume that they probably were, very many times in my life. I can remember one time being forced to march a whole lot more miles than I wanted to march in hot weather, and being so exhausted I thought I couldn't make it any further. But try to picture this boat full of these men. Jesus is the one who had told them to go on out there and go across, and they're on their way across, and they just cannot make any headway. They're trying to go against the wind to the other side. The waves are big, and they cannot stop to rest because their lives are endangered. Now, how would you feel about the person who had just sent you into those conditions? Now, I hope that they maintained their faith, but I can't help but suspect, in their exhaustion and being tired and in the late night and in all of the circumstances, that they were beginning to wonder about the wisdom of one who would send them into that circumstance. Well, while they were there, under those circumstances, they saw Jesus coming upon the water. Now, think about how far out they are on the lake. And they're seeing a person coming on the water. Immediately, some of them thought that they were seeing a ghost, and they were terrified. Jesus identified himself, and Peter immediately, as we always often see Peter does, impulsively jumps right in, said, "Lord, if it is you, let me come to you. Bid me to come to you upon the water." Jesus said, "Come," and Peter did so. Now, we read this story, and I know we often maybe are a little bit hard upon Peter. He was the one who started to walk on the water, and when the waves and wind were fierce about him and he saw them and looked upon them, he fell again into the water and called upon Christ to save him. But we ought to stop for a moment anyway and compare and contrast Peter with the other apostles in the boat. Peter was the first to recognize, "This is the Christ." Peter was the first to respond and say, "Let me come to you on the water." Peter got out of the boat and began to do so. Now, his faith did waver. He did look at the wind and the waves, and he did begin to sink. But everyone else was still silent and standing on the deck while Peter was trying to do something. Now, we don't admire his lack of faith upon looking at the wind and the waves, but let's admire his willingness to do and to act upon his knowledge of who Christ was, and at least to then continue to be as faithful as he could be in the future. Well, after Jesus and Peter entered the boat, the winds died down. And if they had had doubts about this one who had sent them into the storm, all of those doubts were now gone. And again, that's speculation that they did. But if they did, they now recognized who this one was. They had allowed themselves to forget for a moment that this was God in the flesh. And they even began, according to the account in Mark 6, to remember his other miracles and to be amazed that this, the Son of God, was in their midst. And so we read in verse 33, "Then they that were in the ship came and worshipped him, saying, Of a truth, thou art the Son of God." Well, beginning in verse 34 and following, we read of additional acts of miracles that Jesus performed, and we ought to just look at these quickly, or to look over this very quickly. All of those who were diseased in the region of Gennesaret were brought to him and healed. Now, that's a quick statement, but think about the implications of it. If you were to bring a faith healer into this town, and I suppose they come to this town a whole lot more than they do Ridgeville, West Virginia, a lot more market here, I suppose. But if you were to bring one into this town, and I had a fellow visiting me the other day who told me he did have the miraculous gift of healing, and I invited him to go with me to the hospital because there really were some people there who needed his services, and he wasn't able to do that. But really, compare and contrast a modern-day fake healer with Jesus. He healed everybody there. And none of them, if there had been a hospital when he had come to town, it would have been absolutely empty when he left town. And yet, those who claim to be able to do that will often say, "Now, you go home and you'll be seeing steady improvement over a period of time. Then I'll slap you on the head next time a little bit better and yell a little louder or something, and we'll see if we can't make more improvement the next time." But Jesus truly healed, and that would have been an amazing thing to have done that. We are not impressed with modern fake healers because they're not healing anybody. But if you'd been there on that day and seen what had occurred there with people who had been blind from birth, people who had been lame for years and in your presence, people who had been maimed in ways that you could see and that you then observed that they had been healed, it would have been an amazing thing to see. Well, we come to chapter 15 and Jesus encounters the Pharisees and scribes. You know, critics are amazing creatures. We often see them in our churches after they have been to worship services and have observed the preaching of the gospel of Christ, having heard great lessons about the God who created the heavens and the earth and about the salvation that is offered to man through Christ. Even in those services where they witness the baptisms of those who really do believe that it's true and really do want to be Christians. They hear sermons on the beauties of heaven that awaits us. All of the glorious things that God has prepared for those who love Him. And then on their way out the door, after a lesson like that, they come to us and they shake our hand and they say, "Why was the thermostat turned lower today than it normally is?" After all of those things happening, they can throw cold water on wonderful things like that with nothing more than a question. Well, I can't help but think of the Pharisees and scribes in the same light. Try to watch what has led up to their encounter here in the 15th chapter. All of these amazing miracles in public have been done repeatedly. 5,000 people have been fed. This man has walked upon the water. Everyone healed of all kinds of diseases. All of these kinds of things happening. And then Jesus comes to them and they have a question. Now, what would be the reasonable question to ask if you had seen God in the flesh performing these miracles? The only reasonable question would be, teach me the truth so that I can know how to live my life in accordance with the will of God. But the Pharisees encounter this Jesus and they have a question, and that is, why do your disciples transgress the traditions of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread. That's just like the person asking about the thermostat after such important preaching. And again, they were not asking for information because they were ignorant of the will of God and wanted it. They were presuming to know the will of God. And by means of a question, although some questions say more than they really are asking, and that's what this is, really, it's more of a declarative question, if you can call it that. They were saying, in effect, your disciples don't wash their hands before they eat, and they ought to. And they were rebuking this one who, in effect, or they were in effect rebuking this one who they ought to have been dying to know the truth that he could reveal to them. Well, Jesus answered this by pointing out to them that they transgress the law of God in the traditions that they themselves had come up with. Their law was an addition. Even this one of washing hands. The law of Moses had never taught them that they had to wash hands in this manner prior to meals. It didn't have anything to do with hygiene. It was just a change that they had introduced into the things that God had revealed. It was an addition. It was unauthorized. It was added. It was beyond what God had revealed. Therefore, they were wrong in presenting it. Now, it was not one that we would in some sense say was directly contrary to a law of God. It was in addition to, and therefore wrong. And therefore contrary, just simply because God had not revealed, and they had said they had been told not to add to what God had revealed. You know, there may be human traditions that we sometimes submit to or create. Now, we sometimes hear those of a liberal bent talk about this and talk about things that are not human traditions. They talk more about those things that are truly divine things that we have no right to touch. But some brethren in some places, it appears, do come up with rules that are not in the New Testament and demand that we follow them. For example, the New Testament teaches us that a heretic is to be warned, is to be rebuked. If they will not repent, they are to be withdrawn from. And yet over the years, some have developed this idea, well, the thing to do is pressure them to leave in some way and then write a nice letter of commendation to the church where they want to place membership. You can save a whole lot of trouble that way. Now, this recently happened to me where I did have an absolute need, duty, if I understand the New Testament, to confront one who was not only teaching several things that were sinful and wrong, but ready to divide a church over very serious things. I received a phone call saying, now, you don't do that. And in effect, the thing to do is to leave them alone. If they'll go someplace else, write them a letter, and it all will be well. Now, I've interpreted maybe a little too much on that one, and maybe too much. But the truth is, sometimes we come up with these ideas of how things ought to be handled, and then we use those as a standard for judging those who do what the Bible says, because we assume that we know the best way to do those kinds of things. What we need to do is open our Bibles and do our duty. And be careful to not allow ourselves to be influenced by human traditions. Even good people, in a sense, can submit to and endorse and encourage things they ought not. And in the name of peace and in the name of harmony, let's never transgress the law of God by coming up with our own rules that are contrary to the will of God. Well, Jesus went on to point out another human tradition they had similar to this, and that was the practice of not honoring their father and mother. They were told to do so in the law of Moses, and that would include helping their father and mother if they were in financial need. But the Jews had come up with a system whereby you could say, all of the money that I would, all of the goods and things that I have that I would give to my father and mother would otherwise give to them, I hereby pronounce dedicated to God or dedicated to the temple, korban. And from then on, you had no duty to honor your father or your mother. They could be destitute, they could be starving to death, and it would be wrong to dishonor the vow that you had made and give a crust of bread to your mother or father. And this human tradition was being allowed. Not only allowed, it was being enforced by the Jews. When the law of Moses said so clearly and so simply, honor your father and your mother. Anytime people open the Bible to look for loopholes and begin to look at the conclusions that they do not like, they will always come up with something that did not originate with God. And these had done exactly that. Their tradition, in effect, had nullified the Word of God. Their tradition was not of faith. It was not something that God had taught them to do. It was contrary to what God had taught them to do. Any truth-denying, presumptuous principle needs to be abhorred by God's people. Not only that, but the Pharisees, with all of their outward show of devotion, which really was more directed to people, apparently. Apparently, they wanted to demonstrate to other men how devoted they were to God, rather than with pure and simple and contrite hearts express to God how devoted they were. And in their presumptuous ways of acting, trying to look as if they were wonderful and dedicated to God, in their impressing other people, they had failed in at least two ways. They taught what was wrong, and even their wrong actions of false teaching were not motivated by true and properly motivated hearts. Jesus quoted Isaiah, "This people draweth nigh to me with their mouth and honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." We need to be careful that we not allow ourselves to engage in all kinds of acts to impress people when we're not even thinking about the God of heaven to whom we ought to be expressing genuine and real worship, whether anyone else ever notices or appreciates it. If we're not careful, we'll become as they were, becoming human-centered. Well, quickly, the apostles apparently were still interested in impressing the Pharisees, which is hard to understand in some ways, but it's almost a humorous thing, knowing who Jesus is and knowing who these men are. When Jesus got finished talking to them, the apostles, in effect, said, "Don't you know you offended the Pharisees?" And you read that, at least I do, and I can't help but wonder, so what? Why are you approaching Jesus with such a statement? And yet, apparently, they thought it mattered a great deal. Jesus said, any plant that my Father's not planted needs to be rooted up. Leave them alone. If they're not going to pay attention to truth, we will do that. Let's look again at, begin in chapter 15 and verse 29, and just begin to take note once again of the miracles and the multitudes marveling at those miracles. Again in chapter 15, beginning in verse 32, another situation almost like the feeding of the 5,000 comes up, and the apostles ask an amazing question. How are we going to feed these people? They had just fed 5,000. Now they're in a similar circumstance and asking the question, how are we going to do this? You know, sometimes it takes a while for the truth to sink in for some people. These were the apostles Remember this the next time you're in a Bible class and someone raises a hand and asks a question that they asked last week and they asked the week before and they asked 2 years ago, and you've answered and they still seem not to get it. The apostles took their time getting it sometimes, and it's hard to understand, but let's try to be patient as Christ was with those about us who do not always get it. Well, we've learned from the great faith and moral courage of John the Baptist. We need to stand firm, say the truth, let the consequences be what they may be, while trusting in God. We've also seen the vacillating faith of Peter and some of the other disciples. From them, I think we learn that we and our brethren can grow from confusion to certainty, but sometimes it takes a while. Peter and the other apostles sometimes vacillated, and yet it's by their hands that we received the New Testament. God was patient with them. We've seen the evil and pretentious motives of hypocritical people, like Herod. And in the end, Herod lost all. And John the Baptist gained all. If men take our lives, they have taken nothing, because God is able to rescue us in the end. We learn from these examples that truth and human ambition can sometimes collide. Let's always, without exception, stand for the truth of God, whether or not it gains for us the approval of men, and whether or not it causes men to admire us in this world. Remember that God is watching. Thank you.